Welcome back to the Ramble Room. We got a full house today. We got the usual complement, plus David Iverson has joined us, and our special guest representative, Mark Jennings, Area 30, House Street. I wanted you to be from 51.
That would have been perfect.
Yeah. At any rate, welcome. We wanted you to kind of give us a brief update of what went on this last session, anything that sticks out in your mind as something that people need to know.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me. Enjoy coming to the Ramble Room whenever I get the opportunity. So there was two or three things that were kind of interesting that hopefully your listeners will enjoy. We passed two, maybe three pieces of pro-life legislation that was really good to see that make it through. We had another four that did not get pulled out of the leadership's drawer. And then we had the gun bill did not make it through. There was some holdups on that.
No pun intended.
Weird.
Yeah, no pun there. And then for the first time in my 7 years, I actually voted for a budget bill. They cut $430 million. And so in my first time ever of having voted for a budget bill, I did, because I'll be honest with you, I don't think we're done. You know, we did cut a handful of jobs, but we did not right size the government. And so, but we did move the needle the correct direction, at least finally. So,
incrementalism.
It seems to be you worked pretty well against us by the progressives.
Yep.
And there's times where we should be looking at that also. So I guess that'd be my main update.
So Mark, why don't you talk a little bit about the special session that was canceled?
Well, the special session, House Bill 150, basically, and I might not get these numbers right, but I think it was 150, basically said that any money coming through the feds would have to come through the legislature, which is constitutionally the appropriations body. And 118, House Bill, I think it was 118, left a little caveat, a little loophole in there that said that if we did not meet by the 1st of September, that then that would revert back to agencies and the governor, to the executive branch. And so I think what happened there, and I wouldn't want to speak to it with absolute certainty, but the feeling that I got from it was that they wanted to appropriate the $1.3 billion, or approximately that was left over after the $300 million that was going to education. The rest of that was to be appropriated. And then there were objectives, Medicaid expansion, since I happen to know this group is familiar with that subject matter. And they were going to run Medicaid expansion as a committee bill. They ran it through revenue, of all places, which it should not have been. It's not a revenue generator.
How many times do you think they target a committee to hear a bill, considering how that committee is staffed, rather than what that committee's purpose is?
Absolutely. If you go back and listen to the revenue committee in Riverton, you'll actually hear Senator Case say that very thing, that we all know that is exactly what occurs. And it is. I mean, you can look at the makeup of the committee and see if there's a bunch of conservatives. You could send it there if you were wanting a pro-life bill to go through. On the other hand, if you wanted to kill something conservative.
Like you had a brand new freshman legislator who was very conservative. And in order to kind of negate his power, you put him on a committee that is overwhelmingly left.
In this particular last year, that was unprecedented, what leadership did. They took and gave most freshmen one committee, and they said that's the way we've always done it. Well, in my 7 years, I have never seen that. Usually there is, because you count up how many members there are on committees and whatever's left over, you might have one person that only has one or two that only has one committee, but everyone usually gets two committees. And so what you've seen that was unprecedented is, if you'll go back and look, you'll see that they stacked their committees with chairmen, and then those chairmen they also put on committees, on other committees, so that they could put more progressives on each committee. If you'll look at that very closely, you'll see kind of a nefarious methodology against conservatives on that, and the freshmen were clearly targeted.
You mentioned in your opening comment something about things didn't make it out of the leadership drawer. Can you relate that for our listeners? What you mean by the leadership drawer and what we've just been talking about the makeup of the—
Sure. In the process of a bill to become law, when it comes through, first it has to go to introduction. And when it goes to introduction, the Speaker of the House, on the House side, the sentence is a little bit different, but basically the same. The Speaker will decide whether or not which bills they want to go move forward. If you have a session like this one, last one was kind of pared down a little bit. I think there were 400 and some bills or something of that nature. And the Speaker will winnow some of those down if he doesn't like a particular bill or something. He keeps it in his drawer. If it makes it through his drawer, then it goes to a committee. And then after it comes back from a committee, if it makes it through the committee process, does not get voted down, then the majority floor leader puts it on the docket. Now, if he doesn't like the bill either, he also can put it in a drawer. The chairman of the committee can put it in a drawer. And so we call it putting it in the drawer and not bringing it out. There are occasions that the will of the body can pull that bill out. I actually tried to pull one of the pro-life bills out and caught them off guard. It was the first time they'd ever seen anyone. They'd seen them try to take it out of the majority floor leader's drawer, but they had not seen anyone take it out of the speaker's drawer. We weren't successful with that, but, boy, they were sweating. So that's what I mean by keeping it in the drawer.
So that gives whatever the leadership it is and how they have achieved that position, that gives them the opportunity effectively to just decide what's going to get heard, what's going to get passed. If there's something we're really not interested in, we're just going to bury it. I'll pick a particular committee that I've already stacked to get rid of it for me because my drawers are already full.
And it works the opposite side to that, too. If they have a bill that they don't maybe want they think committee bills are passed at a much higher rate. Theoretically, the idea is that they're vetted better than personal bills. If you're in leadership and you have a bill that you'd like to see make it through and you don't feel compelled to get the glory for it, you can assign that to a committee. The committee picks it up, or it's assigned to the committee to take. So essentially, the committee is doing your work. And so your bills are much more likely to make it through the process.
Which is what they're going to try to do with Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion, they put through revenue because they knew they had the votes both in the Senate and the House on the committee. I think part all the way back to the special session, they wanted to run that as a committee bill, and it looks like now it's going to have to in a budget session for it to make introduction. The senators, again, have a little different process, but the Speaker of the House, he chooses which ones will be moved forward, and then they're voted on. And it's a supermajority. You have to have 41 votes in a budget session. So in a special session, if you could suspend the rules and change the rules, which, again, is a problem for them because now there's enough conservatives that we can almost block them at will. We don't have enough to always win our side of the argument, but we have enough to block them in a special session if the rules are not changed. So they would have had to change the rules, which would have required a two-thirds majority. And so when the conservatives began to put forward some ideas for bill drafts, part of the reason that I think that they canceled the special session was they were afraid that Medicaid expansion would be at risk because of having to have a rules change. If they could get it to a simple majority, they can win it. But they have to change the rules to get it to there. And so they did not want to risk some of these conservative bills making it through.
Well, Mark, you mentioned a lot of different parliamentary maneuvers, and most of our listeners probably aren't that familiar with how parliamentary procedure works in the House. Could you just give us a real quick rundown of changing the rules and votes and motions and different things?
The House runs off of rules that are based on Mason's and Roberts rules, but they are the House rules also that we agree upon. And when they're first, each time that you have a change of people, you have to go through the rules. And at that point, any rule changes are susceptible to just a 31 majority, a simple majority, 31 out of 60. after those rules have been accepted, if you want to go back and re-amend those, then you have to go back and have a two-thirds majority. So then you have to have 41 votes. And so those rules are very important. The fallback position is back to Roberts and Mason, but if the House rules don't cover it.
Well, and you know, from my perspective, the parliamentary rules of the chamber are intended to protect the minority, correct?
By and large, yeah. I would say that's the correct way to look at that. It was pointed out the rules for committees. At the beginning of each session, at the end of the first session, the interim committees, the House and the Senate, will meet and they will decide on the rules that they accept for that committee. There's a pretty good sized debate going on because in the Senate they feel like they're outnumbered. They can have what they call cram downs, and you'll see it a lot off of appropriations. Those committees are made up of 9 House members and 5 Senate. And so the rules that are available is a simple majority of all the members of the interim committee. So if you have 14 people, if you have 8, you're going to win it. And if you don't, it goes the other way. What has happened, I've sat on judiciary for 4 years, and I actually proposed the rule change that said you have to have a majority of each chamber. So in the Senate, you have to have 3, and in the House, you have to have 5. And if you don't have that, you've spent a lot of time that when it comes out of that committee, if you go to a simple majority of the members, you know, a lot of times you'll work for 3 meetings, 6 days or more. And when it gets to that chamber that feels like that it's been a cram down, usually the Senate, they say, we weren't for this in the first place.
So you've effectively wasted all that time.
Your
rule change would try to short-circuit that.
Management Council suggested this year that they go to a simple majority of the chambers, and so far of each chamber. And so far, every committee that I've been in, that is the rules that they adopted. So, in effect, I'm not sure why the senators have gone along with that. It doesn't make good sense to me to waste a bunch of valuable time.
Can you tell us what happened to SAPA?
I can. I won't.
First of all, maybe we should state what SAPA is, because some people might be listening to this and not know.
SAPA is Second Amendment Preservation Act. How far back do you want me to go? You want me to go back to when I ran it?
Well, see, back then we were just talking about muskets, so that probably doesn't apply today. Yeah.
I ran that bill 2 years ago and took it from Missouri that was attempting to run it at that time. When I ran that bill, it can be in certain parts heavy-handed towards law enforcement. Now, that having been said, it needs to be worked out because there are things that law enforcement needs to understand, that we, the citizens, are the ones that own this country. And this is our right. And law enforcement was very hesitant to come on board.
That's being charitable.
Yeah. So one of the committee members resurrected that. We actually ran it as a substitute bill. When it got to the Senate, and it passed the House, overwhelmingly, when it got to the Senate, they proceeded to gut it even more. And so as a philosophical idea, my thinking was to go ahead and allow it to become law and put the framework in place so that the next year we could come back and put more teeth back
into it. More of that incrementalism.
Incrementalism. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a philosophical difference between myself and several of the other, especially on the Senate side. So this year, the senators decided to run that, and in essence, the same problems came up. And so one of the other senators, my bill actually made it through. It made it through the House and the Senate, but it was recalled, and where it died on a technicality because some of the senators did not want to do incrementalism. It was really, really the end game.
I can think of at least one.
Yeah, I think there's just one there.
Yeah, and he ran the same bill this last year. And when it was offered to basically take out the law enforcement part, Senator Hicks ran that from a standpoint of, we're not going to get this out. We're not going to get it past law enforcement lobbies if we don't get it out of the Senate. And so, and I've talked to him about this. The idea was to get it over to the House, have some of the House members then put some of those teeth back in. Mm-hmm. Would they have been successful? We'll never know now. Because when he did that, then the sponsor killed it.
Right. You'd figure if every state, this would be the least likely to let that bill die. That's kind of concerning.
You know, I think there is some pretty broad support for it. The real issues are in the details. You know, if you're going to get law enforcement lobbies on board, that's where that incrementalism is probably going to have to happen. They're a very powerful lobby.
Well, and I don't think that they're playing fair, Mark.
No.
With the last version of the SAPA bill, you know, there was a meeting brokered between law enforcement and the bill's sponsor. I know this because I'm the one that set up the meeting. And, you know, the bill's sponsor addressed all of their concerns, amended the bill, and then when it got to the Senate, well, then they continued to gut it. So, you know, what I'm saying is I don't think they're playing fair at all.
Sometimes politics makes for strange bedfellows.
Hear, hear.
And sometimes you have to look at the long game, I guess is where I'm coming from with that. And so it's a philosophical difference between myself and Senator Bouchard. I think we should have put the framework in place. And now with the present administration, I think people would have been far more interested in putting more teeth in instead of less.
Since you mentioned that philosophical difference, I'm going to say I think to our listeners, we're going to have a really interesting show coming up because Chip Nyman's going to come back and join us. We're anticipating John Baer. Dave will probably be back, the rest of the crew. We might have to just go rent a hotel room so we can be comfortable. But that's one of the things that I want to talk about is there's this situation where you go as a representative, and Chip saw this. He felt like his duty was to represent his constituency to the best of his ability. And then other people brought it up and said, well, we represent the whole state, or
how
other
ridiculous
nonsense ideas like that. Just my opinion. But there is this balance between doing what you feel is absolutely right and doing what is practical. And that's a tightrope that every legislator has to walk. And very, to me, it's a fascinating discussion, especially considering what might happen when I find myself there. Where do I decide what's practical versus what's right? How do you make those moral decisions? So I don't want to get into that right now. Let's save that for that show. But I think that's a good one. What I would like to get into right now is by the Constitution, both the state and the United States have a separation of powers between the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And what I am seeing on both the state level and the national level, and I would say I noticed it first at the national level, but the more I become aware of what's going on in Cheyenne, the more I realize that it's every bit as true here, is a weeding out of the authority of the people that hold the purse strings of the legislative branch. It's being usurped by the executive branch through a process of executive orders, through the process of appointing commissions or bureaucracies that then impose regulations, and also by a judicial branch that goes out and legislates from the bench. Could you maybe touch on some of what we're seeing where the legislators are being effectively reduced, or their power is being effectively reduced and replaced by an overarching authority from the governor? Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that happens on a pretty regular basis. I think you can make the argument, certainly at the national level, the founders basically wanted the legislative branch to be almost the more powerful.